Good morning. Katie, I have to say that first song, it made me cry. And I'm feeling very emotional right now, so apologies if I just start weeping. It's as if you just sang my journey from the East Coast to the West Coast. My gosh, there's so much truth in those two songs that you sang that I'm so honored and humbled to be speaking after you. Maybe I'll start with a question. How many people here have ever had a psychedelic experience or a mystical experience or something that's happened to them that they couldn't necessarily explain, like knowing something in advance or deja vu or literally anything where you're like, that was kind of weird? Has anybody ever had an experience like that? Oh, loads of us, right? It's pretty common. Okay, how many people in this room feel like they really understand like what was going on there? Like they got it. They know what happened. Any of us? No. It's weird, right? My talk today is gonna be about trying to put some frameworks around some of these experiences that we all have that are really common. And I wanna just say how appreciative I am that you all of you felt comfortable in raising your hands, because I feel like this is a topic that is something that we all experience. And then we don't talk about it at all. And then it becomes this weird thing that we kind of just shove it in the corner and we carry on with our lives. So I also have had these experiences along with all of you. Most of mine started when I was really little. Not the psychedelic ones, the mystical ones. I should probably caveat that. When I was really young, I would have these experiences of hearing things and seeing things and I don't know what was going on. And my father, so it's actually really fitting that I should be speaking about this on Father's Day. My father was one of the first people I went to just say like, hey, this is happening. And his response to this day remains probably one of the best. He would just look at me and go, mm-hmm. As if to say, yeah, that's a thing. We don't need to put a story around it. Just, it's what it is. It happens. Unfortunately, my dad's version of mm-hmm was no match for my mother's explanation of what was going on, which is that I must be allergic to everything under the sun because I'm hallucinating. So I had this very long list of medications and substances and all sorts of things that by the time I graduated high school that I was allergic to, so much so that I had to carry around a medic alert bracelet because I was hallucinating all the time under the influence of these medicines. And I have to say, I mean, it came from a really loving place, right? She didn't know. There was no explanation for any of this. And I kind of took on her perspective of something must be happening in my brain, right? There's something going on in my brain. And that was a lot of what prompted me to want to study neuroscience. So I want to say, in full disclosure, I am by no means an expert in psychedelic research and in all the things related to consciousness, but I am a lifelong enthusiast of understanding these topics. And my background in neuroscience is mostly in molecular and understanding systems, but it was because I thought maybe that might help me understand some of these things. So I thought what I would do is start with some ways of framing the conversation about what might be happening from a scientific perspective, and then we'll switch into a different perspective. So the scientific perspective tends to be called materialist or physicalist, and it's because it's rooted in something material or physical, like our brains. And I'm going to just give you a few explanations of what scientists think might be going on when we have a psychedelic experience or we have a profound experience when we're meditating. One of the most common ways of understanding it, and one of the simplest, has to do with brain waves, which you've probably heard of before. Have you all heard about brain waves? Yeah. Okay, cool. So brain waves get a lot of press because they're really easy and accessible. So we can measure them by looking at electrical activity in our brain using a little head cap that has all these little electrodes on it that can measure things. And there are a few brainwave states in particular that people have become really interested in. One of those is theta, and the other one is gamma. Gamma is the one that's when you're really focused and attentive on something. And they found that experienced meditators tend to spend a lot of their time in a gamma headspace. The other one is theta. Theta tends to be when we're really relaxed And that one has also been shown to be activated when people are meditating. And so because we've been able to measure people's brains while they're engaged in these types of experiences, we've also been able to create things to help people experience things. So if you are not a meditator but want to know what it's like to be in a theta brainwave state, you can use an app. And it will use the right frequency of sound and light to put your brain into that state so that you can know what that feels like. If you want to experience gamma, you can do the same thing. Those same devices will help put you to sleep. They'll help keep you awake. They do all sorts of things. And I just share this to say that there's something going on in our brains because we know that we have some data around it, and then we can produce something that then creates an experience for ourselves. But it doesn't feel like the whole story. I don't know that I can go from brainwaves to, I'm not sure, that feeling of love and oneness with everybody or some of the things that I might have seen when I was a kid. So for that, we're going to go to another potential explanation, which is one that's gotten a lot of exposure over the last few years. And that's that there's a network of neurons in our brain that form something called the default mode network. And I'm not sure if you've heard of that before. It involves quite a few different structures, and it's still under investigation. So there's nothing that I'm going to say here that's going to be absolute and definitive. It's just what we know right now. And what we know right now is that our sense of self and the narrative that runs through our heads all the time, that arises from this part of our brain, the default mode network. It also has episodic memory in it. So episodic memory is memory of specific things that have happened. Our whole history, our autobiography, everything related to our sense of self kind of seems to be coming from this part of this network in our brains. So it should come as no surprise to you that psychedelic substances disrupt the default mode network. And they actually suppress it so that other areas of our brain can be more activated. If you listened, to Brad's talk last week, this will sound familiar. When he was talking about tuning into something different, opening up our awareness, this is literally what those substances do. By suppressing one part of our brain that tends to be overly or mostly active and allowing in other parts of the brain and new connections to be made. This area is also suppressed during meditation practices. So breathwork practices, meditation practice, all affect this area of our brain. Interestingly, mindfulness meditation tends to activate it, but in a very specific way, so not to overactivate it, but to kind of activate in a way that has an effect on our sense of self that's a little bit more in relation to other things. So that's really interesting, right? There's this part of our brain that we can actually affect, and that affects our sense of self. So if you've had an experience where you felt like yourself dissolving, or you felt like yourself merging with other people or other things, that might have been related to that default mode network. So that's also really interesting. But again, maybe isn't wholly sufficient for all of you sitting here. There's another theory that I want to explain, and all of these obviously I'm giving you kind of brief tastes of, and then I will share tons of resources with Brad so that you can investigate all of these at your leisure and kind of dive into them, because there's a lot here. This other one actually arose looking at what they call altered states of consciousness, but not looking at psychedelic substances, which is how we understand a lot of the research that's been done on consciousness, but actually looking at anesthesia. So this was developed by an anesthesiologist and a physicist, Sir Roger Penrose and Stuart Hameroff, and they proposed that actually it's not networks of neurons that are causing consciousness or some of these experiences, but it's actually these structures within the brain cells that act as quantum computers. So they can do quantum computations. So now we're merging quantum physics and biology. And because of that, this gives rise to consciousness. And what they've found is that when people are under anesthesia, these structures actually are not as active. So they're not acting in the same way as they are normally. They've also found that these structures seem to be mediating consciousness in the brain, in a space where we never thought that quantum mechanics or quantum physics could ever be operating. So that's also just really interesting. So we've now taken it as, sorry, my voice is going, now taken it as from it could be something related to brain waves, it could be something related to this network, this default mode network, it could be related to quantum mechanics. And at the end of all this, I can say, I don't know. But what's interesting to me is this was where my headspace was for a really long time. It was something related to the brain. And I probably would have stayed in that headspace had it not been for an experience that happened a little over a decade ago, where I was driving down the road thinking about Ebola, as one does. That's the truth. And all of a sudden, everything became so clear. And there was no Allison, there was no anything. I can't even put words around it. I just knew the truth of our existence or something. I don't know, it's very hard to put this into words. I have no memory of what happened during that experience, except when I was done with it, I was on the side of the road crying, and I don't remember pulling over. I have no memory of any of this. And I was so set on all of these things being part of our brain that I called my husband at the time and I told him I had a brain tumor. Because I hadn't ingested anything, so I couldn't possibly explain what would have happened here. It had to be in my brain. So, must be a brain tumor? And he was like, no, probably not that. Probably it's something else. Why don't you take a walk? And I was saying in the pre-talk, I basically threatened him. I was like, well, okay, fine, I'll take a walk, but if I die, it's on you. Because I'm telling you, I should have gone to a hospital. So I took a walk, and of course, I didn't have a brain tumor. But I also didn't have an explanation. And I found that a lot of the things that I had held on to, these understandings of brainwaves and default mode networks and quantum mechanics that might be in our brain, all of which very well may be the explanation. So I don't want to discount that. But in that moment, didn't feel like it was doing anything for me. So that led me to try to figure out, well, okay, how do I understand this? And there's a whole other set of scientists who have been trying to explain consciousness and altered states of consciousness and mystical experiences and psychedelic experiences using a different framework where material isn't fundamental, but what's fundamental is actually consciousness or mind. And I'm just going to give you one example of one of the theories that has arisen from this perspective, and then we'll use that to kind of move us forward. The one that I find the simplest is been given by Bernardo Kastrup. He posits that, actually, it's easier if you visualize it. So why don't you close your eyes? We'll do a little visualization. Okay, so imagine a river, a really gentle, beautiful river that's flowing. And now imagine that there is a whirlpool in this river. And the whirlpool, it's not that there's a rock or a stick or something causing it. It's just a gentle whirlpool in the river. And that is you. That is your mind, your consciousness, your brain. And now, we'll add some more whirlpools for the rest of the people who are here in this room today. That's their mind, their consciousness, their brain. You'll notice that everything is the water. Right? There's nothing specifically different. But in some places, the water is swirling differently than in other places. Got it? Okay, so now you can open your eyes. Thank you for imagining that with me. So his idea is that the river is consciousness, or the river is mind, as he calls it, and that we exist within that. It's of the same substance, but that our brains filter certain things out from the river. Again, to what Brad had said, but just a lovely image of what that can be like. And that as we expand our awareness, we expand our whirlpool. And with less awareness, smaller whirlpool. And some molecules of water get in, and some molecules of water do not get in. And that's his explanation. But everything fundamentally is mind, and that the material world arises from mind. So it's a totally different perspective. And what I loved about this when I was in that blissful space was the oneness of everything. So I love that I could just walk around and just be like, well, everything's the same, and no separateness and love. And again, not that that's not true. And I was hit pretty hard by somebody as I'm walking around with my everything is so blissful and lovely and all is one space. I met somebody at a learning and memory conference who confronted me with a pretty stark statement. He had been studying consciousness for many years, and he felt really interesting. So I approached him and I said, oh, tell me about yourself. And he said to me, 99.99% of what you do is on autopilot. The humans are 99.99% autopilot. And I said, yeah, I know that. Right? As if I'm not part of this conversation at all. Right? Yeah, I know. Everybody else, sure. Not me. I'm in the river. I'm great. And he can sense that that's what I'm feeling. And so he says to me, no, everyone, 99.99% autopilot. It's starting to sink in, and I'm like, I don't really like this. Okay, maybe most people, but maybe I'm like 60%, you know, always wanting to be special. So he's like, no. And as he says this, it really starts to hit me that that is the case. And full disclosure, I'm still very much on autopilot, because if you haven't noticed, my face is very brightly red from being outside yesterday, because in my head, I don't get sunburn. And that is not true. So I went out on autopilot just going, no, I don't get sunburn. And the sun was like, no, you do actually. So I'm still there. But what was so powerful about that statement, and what I feel is so important about this conversation, is that we can have these experiences and we can have explanations for them, and we can live in these spaces of spirituality or of oneness and still actually not behave in a way that is unique to ourselves. We can still behave in a way that's on autopilot. As we said in the pre-talk, I could be in the space of oneness with everything and someone would cut me off on the freeway and there I'd be shaking my fist. But no, I'm super cool. Love everyone. So we started working together and we came up with a framework that I want to share that I have found to be really helpful. And the reason I wanted to share all these different frameworks is because I found them to be useful at different stages in my life. And as we all go through our psychedelic, mystical, whatever, who knows what's happening experiences, sometimes it can be helpful to have some framework to put around it. So what we talked about, he and I, and what we wrote about was about the fact that we as humans, we all have a history, and we're aware of our history. We can access it at any time, right? So if I ask you to close your eyes and imagine an apple, I can now ask you to imagine a blue, purple, yellow, green apple. And you can do it, right? But you've never seen a blue, purple, yellow, green apple. You just have a history of knowing an apple, and a history of knowing all these different colors, so you can put them together. In that sense, humans are very creative. We can use our history and our ability to access our history and create something new from it. From my perspective, that seems to be a uniquely human trait. I might be proven wrong about that, but that seems to be uniquely human. It's certainly something that we can do. So if we're always creating from a place of autopilot, right? If we're always putting things together that are actually just from our history, what do we get? We get copies of copies of copies of copies of copies of copies of copies, right? Which is a lot of what we see. We get reactions to things and responses to things that are not from a place of choice or from a place of awareness. They're just simply the way that we've always done it. right? Always. Me going outside without sunscreen, something I've always done. Not paying any attention, no awareness around it. The reason for me, personally, to explore psychedelic spaces, to explore mystical experiences, isn't awareness for awareness' sake. I mean, it's cool, but for me, it's insufficient. It's now become because I don't want to be on autopilot anymore. I want to create from a space of intention. I want to create from a space of awareness. And that's not possible if I'm hanging out in my default mode network all the time, doing the same thing over and over again. So doing something different, a breath work, a meditation, a substance, whatever it is, to shake that out can be really helpful in creating from a space of authenticity and to create something really new in the world. So I'll leave you with this thought from Ken Kesey, who was an icon in the 60s. He, if you're not familiar with him, he brought LSD to the Bay Area and was kind of a contemporary of Timothy Leary and Aldous Huxley, but had a very different kind of mindset of it. He would do these things in the Bay Area called acid tests. He'd bring lots of people together. I don't know if you're all familiar with this, but he'd bring lots of people together and he'd dose them with high doses of acid, of LSD, and then he'd just be like, can you handle it? Can you handle what happens here? And people would come back to these, from what I understand, because I obviously was not there during this time, but people would come back for these experiences. And at some point, after some amount of time, he started to realize that people were opening the door, so the opening the doors of perception that Brad was talking about last week, and then they would close the door and go about their life, which is very similar to what had happened to me after I had that epiphany. I had this epiphany, and then I just carried on with my life. And what Ken Kesey started to challenge people to do was to say, look, you can open up the door as much as you want, but you got to walk through it at some point. You've got to actually do something different. And so this is my encouragement to all of us to say that as we expand our awareness, to not just sit in the, isn't that so cool? Everything is super cool colors and is floating around me, or, well, there's an entity over there. That's awesome. Which is one perspective and is totally valid. But also, what are we going to do with that? What are we going to create because we know this now? What are we going to create with each other and within ourselves? So I'm very excited to see what we all create at the end of this summer of exploring psychedelics. I really appreciate your letting me share these perspectives with you all. As I said, I'm going to send a whole bunch of resources over to Brad. I help run a group called Exploring Consciousness with Dr. Mona Sobhani, who wrote a book called Proof of Spiritual Phenomena. If any of this is interesting to you, we love having people join our community. It meets mostly virtually once a month, and it's all people who are just really interested in this intersection of science and spirituality. How do we understand consciousness? How do we understand what we're creating? And then we host an annual meeting every year at the Society for Neuroscience meeting, where we subversively talk about consciousness, even though they don't really like it very much. and spirituality, which they also don't like very much. But we are changing minds and creating something new. So if that's of interest, I'll also put that in there, because we'd love for all of you to come be a part of it and extend these conversations. So thank you very much.